Welcome to The Sandbox, a Marvel Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. podcast. Participate in the podcast and get your level 7 access by calling 304-837-2278 or go to goldenspiralmedia.com/feedback. And now, here are your hosts, Mike and Dave.
Welcome, everybody, to The Sandbox, a Marvel's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. podcast, where Dave is your dream and I am your nightmare. My name is Mike.
And I'm Dave, and this is show number 107 of The Sandbox, where we'll be discussing Season 6, Episode 5 of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., titled The Other Thing, which aired June 14th, 2019.
And this episode was written by George Kitson, and it was directed by none other than Lou Diamond Phillips, so it's nice to have him joining in on the fun. And this did have a very distinct directorial flair, I guess you could say, from the standpoint of the flashbacks that we got to Tahiti. And very well done, I think, in that respect. But in show news, I want to bring up that we did actually publish the article version of the Clark Gregg interview that we had. And Dave, that was just such a fun discussion. I really, really can't wait to share the audio with the listeners on that one.
Yeah, and it's always fun, and I noticed you put this in the Facebook group before the interview got started, and he had certain expectations of what he was getting into, yeah. But the rep sorted it all out.
Yeah, he thought when we said, we're just going to record a quick intro for the podcast, and he's like, wait, what? I thought this was for a magazine article, because he almost sounded not too pleased that, what am I, slumming it on some podcast somewhere? But yeah, that was fun. But the other thing that I wanted to point out in the pre-episode discussion part of our podcast is the really cool episode title that popped up here, The Other Thing, because it appears in the episode twice, both from Clark Gregg, one of which is him trying to figure out May and why she hates him so much, and she must hate his counterpart as well. But then he goes, oh, wait, no, it's the other thing. Meaning she loves him. And then in the flashback, Clark Gregg also is in pain at one point, and May says, what, did you have too much to drink? And he said, no, it's the other thing, meaning his fatal disease. So I just thought that was a really clever bit of writing to fit in the episode title in two different contexts.
Yeah, and you and I don't talk about the title and the meaning as it pertains to that particular episode, and it's not that they aren't meaningful. I guess just for whatever reason, we have so many other things that I guess we forget.
Exactly. So that was a nice little tidbit that I figured I'd toss in there before we get going. But as relates to the Clark Gregg interview, you probably noticed we did publish episode 106 as our showrunner interview. So hopefully people enjoyed that. And I did mention in the intro outro of that podcast about the fact that we talked to Clark Gregg, and that will be coming to the feed in July. So something to look forward to. But let's go ahead and get into it with our episode discussion. Now, Dave, before we get into the episode discussion, I just want to get some general impressions out there, because folks who are listening to this podcast, maybe after reading my review on Den of Geek, may have noticed I gave it a 3.5 out of 5, which is still a good rating, but it's not as high as I usually give. I feel like there were some narrative plot holes in this episode, some leaps that the audience had to make to bridge certain gaps.
Yeah, and certainly for me, a lot of that came with Fitz and Simmons and the Chronicom that has come and really taken charge of our heroes in space. So yeah, that was a bit of a leap. And as I said to you before we started recording, it's not that it's not a good episode, but there was just something about it that just didn't get me jazzed the way they usually do.
Yeah, I think it was really due to the wonderful bringing together of the team at the end that kind of glossed over some of the flaws in this episode, because I definitely still really enjoyed it. But yeah, for me, it was the Benson part that kind of messed me up a little bit. But we'll talk about that as we go along and see if our audience agrees with us on that. But you've got a part here in our notes that says, what have we learned? So are we going to be discussing some overall points here?
Well, I think so. And we do, despite what we just said, learn a lot in this episode. And for me, I think one of the most important things we learn is that Sarge and his team are actually trying to prevent planetary disasters. And I think we had a sense that that might be where we were headed.
Maybe. Yeah, we were predicting that.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, now that we know it, and that line he says to May early in the episode that I'm going to turn you, again, I think we knew instinctively what he meant by that, that you're going to end up working with my team.
Right. You're going to see the error of your ways, or at least the noble mission that we have, despite our questionable methods.
Right. And I mean, certainly the next step seems to be that Sarge is going to try to enlist S.H.I.E.L.D.'s help in the battle against the Shrike. Why wouldn't he? And it just seems a natural marriage. And of course, the fly in the ointment is, of course, going to be Snowflake.
Yeah, it's interesting that they left Sarge with only her as he was dealing with May, because we've been mentioning how she's a little off, but they were pretty overt about that in this one, about how she's a little rough around the edges. And she certainly had it on full display here.
Right. Now, we get that term, and again, I tried to look up the spelling, and there were all sorts of things. You know, we don't have the advantage of having available a transcript of the episode, but the Pachacutec influence, and that's not really how the word is used, though, right, with Sarge's team.
I can't really tell. It almost seems like he's naming the creator of the Shrikes, and we do get that term Shrikes to refer to these birds. And Pachacutec, is it the creator that they're referring to, or is it the event, like an Armageddon type of word?
Right, and that seemed to be what they were implying, right? What did the guy in the wall keep saying over and over again?
Well, he said Pachacutec is coming,
right,
which could be used in either of the two meanings I just mentioned. So.
Right. And there's Incan influence, which Benson recognizes. And, you know,
and Taltos mentioned it a few episodes ago as well.
Right. A quick search of Wikipedia lets us know that he was an Incan leader. So the question I have, how would Sarge's team know that name? He certainly implies that this is the first time he's been to Earth. Did he know about Earth previously? But
well, here's what I think about that. It could be that the legend that we hear about could be something that crosses between worlds the same way Sarge does. Or if it's an alternate Earth scenario that we're going with, Pachacutec could exist in many of the different worlds that Sarge has visited, maybe even his home world.
Okay. So we're going with the many worlds theory. I love it.
Yeah.
So now you mentioned just in passing a couple minutes ago, May's dreams, her visions, her memories, whatever they are. So, I mean, what are they? I mean, in them, I think what we all find fascinating is that it appears that either Sarge is using some of the exact same phrases as Coulson, or May's imagining that he does.
Right. I know. I think it's a genuine memory. The thing about the dreams and the nightmares, one person's dream is another person's nightmare, and the other one being hearing the ticking of the clock or something to that effect. So, no, I think that there's some significance to the fact that both versions of the person with this face have used that phrase. So because there are gaps in Sarge's memory, which Clark Gregg certainly mentioned in our interview with him, it's something that maybe could be filled in by these commonalities that we're seeing.
Right. And May is sort of trying to get at that. Well, what do you remember before last month?
Right. And she has this expression on her face that says to me, I'm going to use this to my advantage, or, you know, I've got an ace up my sleeve that I can use against him in some manner. I don't know how, and I don't know what it means, but this is meaningful.
Right. Now, Fitz and Simmons are together with Enoch and the Chronicons, presumably to create a viable time travel situation so that they can reverse a planetary disaster on their home world. So given that the MCU is so complicated at times, and as we try to fit the S.H.I.E.L.D. world into it, pre-snap, post-snap. I start thinking, because of course so many prior seasons of S.H.I.E.L.D. have dealt with whether or not Daisy quaked the Earth apart and all of that. So I'm wondering, is this planetary disaster related to Sarge's team?
And, I think it is, yeah.
And
the
Shrike. Okay.
Yeah, because they talk about something arriving from somewhere else. They don't know where or how it's coming, and it destroyed their entire planet. I mean, the description that Atara gives is very similar to what we can see on Earth. So, yeah, I think that Earth is not the only one seeing these dimensional invasions, but rather it's throughout the galaxy.
Okay. Now, getting back to that prior Earth that we saw fragmented, and of course, everybody blamed it on Quake. And we're talking about different dimensions, multi. I'm wondering if that's, or if I'm just like so far out there that.
No, you're not so far out there, but I do think that you are equating two similar consequences because they are both world destroying. But no, I think they are separate. They did completely avoid an event that had much more to do with Quake and Graviton than it did with Shrikes.
Okay. All right. Now, the one character that I'm really struggling to come to terms with in this episode is Yo-Yo.
Yeah.
And this dark place that she has descended into after Keller's death. And I guess I feel like that's too easy an excuse for her to take this new attitude. Director, anything else I can do for you? It's like, what the heck?
Yeah, that was very, very strange for me. And I think they basically diffused it in this same episode by having her have that discussion with Benson. But it didn't hold together very well for me. The initial anger that she showed didn't really seem to make much sense to me, like that she would blame Mac for what happened, and the little smile that she gave him as Daisy showed up in Zephyr 1 was supposed to be kind of a reconciliation of that, but, you know, it's unclear, and I think they could have made that a little bit more clear.
Well, and she's not new to the team. She understands what she signed up for, and while S.H.I.E.L.D. isn't often incredibly dark, people do die, and loved ones do die. This clearly was not Mac's fault, and then he opens up to her about his own personal doubts when we know it's crystal clear he's doing a tremendous job as the director.
Right. No, I think he handled it very well and reiterated to her, basically, and this is probably why she's angry, that I have to make the tough decisions and I can't be both things. And so she's angry that he has chosen director over her, but obviously, we all agree with the choice that he made, even though it's a tough one for him.
Okay. Now, one of the plot details that I guess I'm struggling again to not make sense of, but to accept. Have we seen the last of the monoliths? I guess I thought we had. it seems convenient. Mac, I need a Quinjet and a pilot. And I'm what, going to go dig up another monolith?
Oh, no, he's going to the Yucatan, which is where they found the very first monolith.
Right.
To investigate it, I guess, in some ways. But yeah, what I had problem with the monoliths, because it's cool. It's a cool callback, because there was a lot of speculation at the time that we saw the Time one, the one with the red stripes on it. We saw it put away into storage, and everyone noticed that there were three monoliths, not just the space one and the Time one, but that third one. And so I don't know if that's going to come into play. What I had problems with is that Dr. Benson made this huge logical leap of, well, let's see, this one's space, that one's time. Maybe we're dealing with life and death. I'm like, what? He has nothing to back that up with. Like, I think we were all guessing that the third monolith might be dimension rather than time and space.
Right, which I think makes a heck of a lot more sense. And certainly that he wants to go to the Yucatan, which is where it was found. And then we've got that Pachacutec influence, so I'm sure there's some kind of connection there.
Yeah.
But I just want to touch real quickly again on May's flashbacks and how we feel about them, in the sense that we do, if we accept that they are accurate, which I do.
Yeah, me too.
Do we need to see Coulson's last moments, is that something perhaps better left unseen?
Well, now, it depends on who you ask. I know, I think it was in the Facebook group, Faith mentioned that she wanted to see a little bit of what they were up to on Tahiti. And I think that may have satisfied a little bit of that. I think the only thing I thought was a little off for me was that it was all very one-dimensional. It was just them sitting in the chairs having drinks. And so there wasn't a ton of depth to it. They did have some nice conversations. I thought it was funny that he was telling her about a time when he wanted to ask her out and had come up with a really cheesy line for it. And she was like, well, you would have been too nerdy for me back then anyway, so it probably wouldn't have actually happened for you. And he was saying that she was too intimidating for him back then. So that was kind of a nice tender back and forth. But the fact that the visual was the same for the entire flashback felt a little flat for me.
Right. And I guess I was trying to explain it in terms of the fact that she is being held by Sarge as a prisoner. She's been drugged. So the first scene we see, I guess you could excuse or explain some of these flashbacks as part of mixing reality with the past and these visions, but obviously both of them have to confront the reality of the shared likeness. And I love it when he suggests that the other, meaning Coulson, must be a synth or a shapeshifter.
Yeah. And she says, you know, if you don't realize that you're the doppelganger, then you've got more problems than I thought. So that was an interesting response on her part. I do feel like the more we hear from Sarge, the more we realize that these gaps that he has are meaningful. And the one really weird detail he shares is that he's hundreds of years old because he's been on planets that travel near the speed of light. It's like, it's not really how relativity works. You know, you might have time pass more slowly around you so that you last longer from other people's perspective, but you're still aging the same way. I mean, I would presume, unless there's something supernatural going on with these dimension hoppers.
Right. Well, I guess I would just explain that in terms of the fact that Sarge is not a scientist. He's not Fitz. Yeah. You know, he's more a soldier. And that may be the way he perceives it and explains it. And as you said, it doesn't exactly hold up.
Well, and that's what I think. That's why I think May is correct in thinking that he's some kind of copy, because he's not complete. Do you get that sense? He doesn't seem like a complete person with a complete history.
Yes. And the fact that he is starting to understand that May is really forcing him to consider that real possibility.
Right. How far back do you remember?
Yeah. Yeah. But we get a test. And again, I almost feel like I'm back in Game of Thrones, you know, kill this person so that we know you're loyal. And obviously that's not really Sarge's motivation here, but she does what needs to be done. And I love Snowflake comes in. Can we keep her, Sarge?
She's really good.
Yeah.
She kicked my ass a few times. But well,
and then there's that little bit of sexual tension between the two. I see the way you're looking at me. You like what you see? And of course, we know May's not reciprocating, and we're not even sure whether Snowflake is really just yanking her chain at that point.
Right. It's still fun, though.
Right. I think more than anything, she respects and is fascinated with May's physical abilities, her fighting acumen.
Right. And May is able to lure her close to knock her out. So there was that.
Right. And we get the explanation of the Shrike, as you brought up earlier, that jump world to world in search of a new host. And is it simply that? Are they searching for something else along the way? I mean, he mentions that they turn the host's energy into pure destruction, but is that all there is?
Well, it seemed like he meant they turned their energy into pure destruction if they were cornered and were not able to propagate. It was like a last-ditch defense mechanism.
Okay, so they're just really jumping from world to world as a matter of survival. They're not searching for anything.
Well, that's a good question. Maybe there is more to it. I think what's interesting is that we talked about how Sarge and his team seem to be up against a hopeless mission, and they've said many things that show that they really don't feel they have too much hope. And if we are correct in our theory that the Chronicom homeworld was also destroyed by Shrike, then what hope do they have stabbing one of them at a time? You know, so I almost get the sense that this whole thing about luring the creator in by cutting off a few limbs, which I think is the analogy that Sarge makes, almost seems like we have, and here's another Game of Thrones reference, a Night King scenario. Kill the creator and the Shrikes fall dead.
Yeah. And on the one level, I hope we don't go that route because it is rather trite at this point. But we do get to see that he's got a case full of knives. But again, I mean, what did I count? Like 12? I mean, how long is that going to last?
Exactly. Maybe they're reusable. But again, they left the one sitting in the body that was discovered by S.H.I.E.L.D. So right. It just seemed an odd choice.
Right. Now, we don't see Deke in this episode, but we do hear about him. And and as Sarge explains to May, we're searching for things that don't belong. What is he? Exhausting.
and you have to figure that off camera, she maybe did explain a little bit about why he didn't belong, but yeah, they never revisited that.
Right. But again, just curious, it probably doesn't really make any difference in the big picture. But, you know, as you said, she's trying to find out whether or not he has any of Coulson's memories. And I would certainly expect that's a path we're going to go down in the next few episodes.
Well, especially with those repeated phrases.
Right.
You got to figure. Yeah.
Right. Now, Mac's tenure as director, really, it faces a number of tests. But I guess, as I mentioned in the introductory discussion, Yo-Yo's attitude towards him has the potential to be really toxic.
Well, there's two things here. One is, I think it's a good kind of irony that she's treating Mac this way, in some ways the same way that he was sometimes surly around Coulson when he was director and defied orders as well. But the other part of it is, I think they really set up this situation to kind of have something to bring Benson in. And Benson is a weird character for me, that he's clearly here to do the things that Fitz and Simmons would have done had they been present. And from a narrative standpoint, they needed a character like that. But his background is very vague, or not vague, very subtle. The fact that he had this husband that died, the fact that he's an alcoholic as a result. But, you know, they brought him in to start the academy, not to be their forensics expert. And here they have Yo-Yo having this problem dealing with a tragedy in her life. And so Benson is able to kind of talk her down off the ledge and explain what he went through. And that obviously helps her come to terms with it a little bit more and stop blaming Mac. So it's almost a situation that's maybe designed to help bring Benson's character into the narrative mix a bit, and also kind of show an arc of mourning and then coming to terms for Yo-Yo. But it just seems a strange choice for that in the mix of all of what's going on around them.
Well, you know, before that, though, she expresses concern that Benson may be in over his head.
Right.
And I wondered at the time whether she really believes that, or she's just being passive aggressive almost. That
Yeah, that's what I got from that as well.
And that the conversation that you just explained, that really diffuses the situation for her. So hopefully that will, coupled with the return of Zephyr, get her back to, you know, the Yo-Yo that we know and love, and that really is, you know, such an integral part of the team. But Zephyr returns to Earth, and okay, you might say it's a visual we've seen 1,000 times. Mac and Yo-Yo waiting for the team to deplane. And of course, we know it's only going to be Daisy, Piper, and Davis, and that there are going to need to be some explanations. But the news that May caught him comes across, and obviously we remember, well, Daisy has no idea what's going on with Sarge.
Well, and in a sense, that scene is specifically designed to show the crossover of the two plot lines. Here's Daisy. She doesn't know about the fake Coulson, and they don't know about what Fitz and Simmons are up to. So it's almost like a introduction of what's to come in terms of catching each other up on the separate plot lines that we've had so far.
Right. Now, the one thing that I didn't notice the first time around is that when everybody's hugging it out, Mac and Daisy are hugging. And it almost felt like a surrogate Coulson, yet it really feels real to me.
Yeah.
That Mac maybe is ready to take on that role of father figure, probably older brother figure.
Yeah.
Would be, you know, more in line with the reality. But I really like that. It just really touched me.
No, it looked completely authentic, probably owing somewhat to the real life bond between Henry Simmons and Chloe Bennett. But even Yo-Yo greeting Davis and Piper felt very heartfelt.
Oh, wait a minute. You're not telling me like they're like Bell Arc, are you?
Not that heartfelt, Dave.
Oh, okay. All right. So then finally, we've got that plan to save the Chronicom homeworld. And Enoch, his scene at the beginning is just gold. He's lamenting his decommissioning, his failure to have meaning in his life. And Gemma and Daisy are trying to buoy his spirits. No. We're your friends. It's like,
because he doesn't know them. This version of him doesn't know what the other version of him did. And I think it's great how they talk him through what he did in their version of the future, where he sacrificed himself to send them back to the past, that his mission was successful. And so now maybe I can recede into the shadows again.
Well, the other thing I really like about that sequence there and their explanation about what he did is that for the viewer, it reminds us of the complexity of the storylines that we've had to deal with over the last couple of years. It's like, oh yeah, okay, that's right.
Yeah. He only knows the little girl Prophet and Fitz.
Right.
That's pretty much it. Right.
So suddenly they find themselves surrounded by a Cylon fleet that has, which is exactly the first thing I thought of. And the BSG episode 33 minutes, I think it's called.
Yeah, they zip in.
Exactly. Oh, my gosh. But again, great scene. Atara, who's also a Chronicom, comes on board, recognizes Enoch immediately, and he's being charged with tampering with the universe. And that's a very real crime, if you will, and it really does have such a wide-ranging meaning, and certainly possibility of meaning, because did his tampering have a ripple effect throughout the universe?
Yeah, I don't know. I was of two minds about this, because on the one hand, she might have been calling him out because Chronicoms are supposed to be in the background. They're not supposed to interfere with what they're dealing with, at least not from an anthropology standpoint. But also the fact that they want them to interfere more now on the Chronicom homeworld's behalf seems to be a little bit of a contradiction. So I almost found myself questioning whether or not when they said they were looking for Fitz because he interfered with the universe, that maybe they were looking for him so that they could do it again, not so they could charge him with a crime. But she does clearly state that it's a crime.
Right. Now, I think Piper gets the sass line of the episode, wouldn't you say?
Oh, the whiny bitch line?
Yeah, when she and Davis are locked up. I don't know. You know, I forget what he was.
I loved that dynamic.
Yeah.
So good.
Right. But Atara tells Enoch that their planet, Chronica 2, is gone, and all that's left of their race is on board this Confederacy vessel that she's commandeered. And again, this is something that we've seen in other shows, whether it's The 100, whether it's Battlestar Galactica. And that's fine, because I guess on one level, it is a logical outcome for a planet that either destroys itself or is destroyed by outside forces.
And I like the fact that they had to steal some Remarath ships, some Confederacy ships, in order to even survive beyond their planet. And so it kind of explains why only a few of their race remain.
Right. But she wants to go back in time, which will enable her to save her planet. And I think anytime you go back in time to try to fix things, you run the risk of unintended consequences. And I think we generally see that is the case. So I don't know whether Fitz and Simmons are going to be able to give her what she wants. So
especially since they had a lifetime to work on the time machine. And I love this little detail that Gemma has to say, is that we don't even know how this time machine was created. It was just there when we got there, because the Gemma and Fitz of the original timeline that had years and years to work on it, it obviously needed the little chunk of the monolith, the little white and red monolith, that chunk that became an heirloom that Deke kept safe, you know, all those years. You know, they don't have that. That's still back home with S.H.I.E.L.D. I do, however, like the fact that they tied these plot lines together even before Daisy got back to the lighthouse, because it did sort of foreshadow the fact that the storylines would start to merge. But how are Fitz and Simmons going to do anything with time travel without at least a piece of that monolith? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know either. And Atara has the attitude right away that if you tell me you don't know something, you're lying.
Right. And they're just terrible at their threats. You know, first they're using Fitz as leverage, then they're using Gemma as leverage, but they're going to shoot the rest of them. But they chase them down a hallway. And then as soon as as Gemma explains that she wants them to be let go and she'll work with Fitz, the Chronicoms just say, okay. You know, there's no argument over it. So it did seem a little bit herky-jerky with their strategizing. I just feel like the Chronicoms should be a little bit more savvy than that, especially considering what we saw from the Hunters.
Right. Now, we've talked at length throughout the 5 years of this podcast about Gemma's growth. And when she tells Atara that, no, Fitz will need me to work with him. And as you said, okay, maybe that was too easy for Atara to just agree to allow those two to work together. But did you see the look that she gives Daisy as she's walking away? Almost as if this knowing glance that I've got some alternative plan, and read my mind. You know, you have to know what it is. Which
yeah, I did see that, but I also was kind of focused in on Daisy's reaction to having to give up Gemma. Here they have accomplished their task of finding Fitz. Gemma wants them to leave and go back home as they originally intended, because, you know, she was successful. She can't ask more of them than that. But Daisy doesn't want to leave Gemma, you know, and I think it's partly that, as well as what you just said about Gemma trying to communicate that she has maybe a deeper game that she's playing.
Right. And I think for Daisy's part, a lot of that goes into the leave no person behind. Simmons was in my care, and, you know, yeah. Personal feelings aside. But the epilogue this week leaves me a little bit flat, you know?
Yeah, because it seemed to only accomplish the tearing apart of the BFFs from Enoch's point of view. But here's what I took from it. I mentioned earlier that Enoch may have realized, once he heard that the future him, the alternate him, sacrificed himself to get the team back and prevent the extinction level event that he came out of the shadows for to begin with, maybe he feels like he can do this. He can basically help his homeworld sacrifice his friendship with Fitz by doing this bad thing and putting Gemma forth as leverage, and recede back into the shadows again. I mean, I think he'll miss Fitz, but maybe that was a purposeful choice on his part.
Yeah, but what's the point of the mist and knocking Fitz out?
Oh, okay. Well, that, yeah. I forgot about that part. Yeah, that was a little weird too, but I think that's just one of those things that's supposed to make us go, what's going on? And then it all will be explained in the future. It was a little weird.
Yeah. Now, you know, in getting back to your initial mention of the 3.5 stars you gave it in the Den of Geek review, yeah, I think you're pretty close. I mean, I tend to grade a little high, maybe too high sometimes, but I certainly can't see myself going beyond a 4. It's a good episode, no question. We get a lot of information. The story is pushed forward on several fronts. But like you said, I think it's just that some things occurred too easily.
Yeah. Well, for me, a 3.5 is good, passable. A 4 is really good. And a 4.5 is like, wow, this is really great. And 5 is perfect. But it doesn't get until it gets into the 3 and 2.5 that I consider it subpar. So I still think it's good.
Okay.
3.5 is a good score for me. So
You don't get a five unless you're 12 monkeys. I know how it is.
Or The Expanse. Yeah. All right. Well, we're going to go ahead and dive into feedback at this point. Dave and I are once again recording this ahead of time because of Father's Day. So we're going to trade off like we've been doing in previous podcasts. So you'll hear Dave and I reacting alone to each of your different feedbacks. But here we go, and we'll toss it to our future selves for the feedback segment. All right, let's start off our feedback segment with Skimmins. Skimmins says, "Why am I dizzy? Because you have violent tendencies." That's fair, Sarge. While I think the actor playing Enoch is doing a great job with the performance, I'm still just meh to the character. I do feel for him, though, with everyone conning Enoch for their own use. Poor Davis is never going to live down that high. 3 minutes in, and I'm already loving Atara. I feel they intentionally showed us May's left hand on Coulson so we could see there's no ring, because really, a proposal would top off that flashback. But at the same time, I can't see Coulson asking because he knows it won't last for long and couldn't do that to May emotionally. Put Gemma Simmons in danger and Daisy Johnson will do anything to protect her also. You know you've created an interesting plot, or at least interesting characters, when you slowly dole out information for an arc, but it's still mysterious, yet no one is frustrated by it. That's I say that a lot, Skimmins. That's a thing that I always use to gauge if you can actually keep the pacing just right, but the mystery doesn't frustrate you. That's Sarge and company this season. Well done on them, writers. Daisy and Gemma are separating? I'm crying too, Gemma. Gemma looking directly at Daisy when she says she's sorry for hurting them, and then that last look back, plus Daisy saying she won't leave Gemma. Oh, my Skimmins heart, I knew you would love that scene, Skimmins. Chloe and Elizabeth know exactly what they're doing, and I appreciate it. The show might not ship Skimmins, but I can always count on the girls, too. Newsflash, dude, May eats nightmares for breakfast. See, Enoch, this is why you should never trust Fitz emotionally. So what is the plan long-term with time travel? Yes, the people get their planet back, maybe, but is this plot also going to undo previous seasons by extension? Are they going to bring Coulson back via this? Because can we not? Again, after all the hyped stuff they did for season 5, if they walk it back more than they already have with Fitz, I'm going to ask what's the point of anything on the show, as it could all change at any moment. So why get attached to anything? Maybe it won't be that extreme, but I just have reservations when it comes to this series and time travel after how they handled everything in season 5. I think that's a valid reservation, Skimmins, but I think they're not going to go that route. It's just going to be one of those things where the technology may be used to save Chronicom. But yeah, I don't think they're going to redo anything. But you bring up an interesting point. Are they going to use it to bring Coulson back at some point? I have a lot of reservations about saying never at this point, because I want to say that Coulson's a done deal, but I don't know. It just seems like there might be a possibility there. So I understand your reservations there. A good episode overall, says Skimmins. In regards to next week, boo Fitzsimmons, yay Dark Fitz. I assume Skimmins is referring to something in the preview, which I have not seen. Will season 2 Dark Gemma be there too? Because she can really be interesting. Looks like they're the focuses of next week, but I do wonder if we'll get a Daisy Sarge scene to set that up moving forward. Snowflake is going to be so jealous. Also, bring on the start of the Skimmins reunion plot, because that's a connection I can get behind. And I do think you will get that reunion, so yeah, I'll be interested to see how they greet each other. All right, Skimmins, thank you very much.
All right, we also heard from Taltos, who says, "I find it hard to believe that Yo-Yo could look at an analysis of the Shrike crystal structure and immediately recognize it was being connected to the monoliths. I could maybe see that happening with Fitz or Simmons, but I don't recall Yo-Yo ever showing an aptitude for science. I would have found it much more credible if Benson had run the analysis through the SHIELD database, come up with a match to the monoliths, and then asked Mac about them." And that makes perfect sense. I didn't even think about it the first time around. I just took it for granted that Yo-Yo knows what she's talking about. She also says, "I can see them explaining away the identical DNA, but Coulson and Sarge using the same sayings is a different issue. Sarge said he's been alive for 100 Earth years, though I suppose it's possible that he has implanted memories that just make him think that. On the other hand, the Fitzsimmons storyline seems to be heading towards building a time machine. Could a future episode see the Chronicoms creating a duplicate of Coulson and the team sending him back in time to fight Pachacutec? If they still had brain scans from the framework and they were used in the duplicate, it could explain the identical sayings. And if Sarge has truly been alive over 100 years, it would be understandable why the word Coulson is only vaguely familiar to him. In a causal loop, the team might even name him Sarge because that's the name they know him as. Taltos, I gotta say, wow, I didn't even think of that. I love that. Of course, that negates my multiverse theory, parallel universes and all that, but I really like that.
And we have an audio feedback from Faith, who has a little bit of a sass treat for us at the end of her feedback. So let's take a listen.
Hi, guys, it's Faith. Last week, I asked for some Tahiti flashbacks, and this week I got some. Not a lot, but it was a nice start, and my Falinda fangirl heart is absolutely bursting. Also, can May just get a break? Like, how much heartache and pain does one character really need? Dear Lord. I do love how she handles it, though. A lot of punching can really make a person feel better. I was also quite glad to see her still not trust Sarge and Snowflake. She might understand that they aren't the imminent threat she thought they were, but they're still unknown and dangerous, and I'm happy that she's bringing them back to headquarters. Yay to most of the team finally being back together. Boo to still keeping Fitzsimmons out in space. I really hope that only lasts one episode. I said it before, I'm gonna say it again, I'm kinda done with space. Let's get home already. I didn't watch the preview, so I have no idea what's actually going to happen next week, but I'm hoping for some Fitzsimmons time. I can't wait to see the new dynamic between Simmons and non-time-traveling Fitz. It should make for some interesting storytelling. I'm also looking forward to seeing Daisy's reaction to Sarge. That might bring on some serious sass. And speaking of, a little May sass bonus.
Your boss runs a tight crew. Everyone has a role but you. I can't figure out.
Because I'm so mysterious.
I was gonna go with nuts.
All right, guys. Can't wait to hear what you have to say. Bye.
All right, that's some great May sass. Thank you for sharing that, Faith. And I do agree that space is becoming a little bit played out. I don't think I got as tired of it as quickly as you did, Faith, but I am ready for that to finish up and see how it maybe ties back in with the rest of the storyline, because I do think that time travel monolith has to come into play at some point, and aren't they going to have to go back to Earth to get it? So we'll see if that plays out. And I do agree with all the stuff you said about May and how she really is being such a great judge of character, and her reactions are just spot on. And the flashback, although I mentioned in the earlier in the podcast, was a little bit flat in terms of the setting, it did give us some great moments, and it would have been missing if they hadn't given us at least a little flashback to that. So thanks for that audio feedback, Faith.
And we heard from Daryl Washington, who says, the show takes an unexpected break and comes back with an episode directed by Lou Diamond Phillips. I didn't even know he directed TV. Very excited to see his name attached to Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Yeah, I didn't either. And apparently he hasn't directed all that many episodes of television, but I certainly think he did a fine job here. I didn't like Yo-Yo planting doubts in Mac's head about Dr. Benson. This is not the time for there to be doubts about fellow team members. Couldn't agree more. I think this is the first episode that has combined the space and Earth plots, and I'm glad because now we don't have to wait 2 weeks to find out what will happen with either one. My heart broke to see Daisy and Gemma separated. It's worrying me I'll spend the rest of the season not seeing them together again. I'll miss them together very much. Snowflake is being her usual adorable, nutty self. I think she's in love. Not looking forward to seeing the pain on Daisy's face when they tell her what's been going on. And if you thought May had a bad reaction, I just worry about Daisy's. Now, I really like your assessment about Snowflake and who she in love with, May. I mean, that is something that I can see. But is she in love with May from the standpoint that May is sort of a mirror image of her in terms of physical attributes, fighting skills, and the like. But regardless, Daryl, great stuff as usual.
All right. Thank you to everyone who contributed to our feedback segment this week. We always enjoy that and appreciate it a whole lot. And there was a lot of meat to sink your teeth into with this episode. So thanks for all those great thoughts that you had. But that's going to be it for this edition of The Sandbox. Keep up with show news and fan interaction by following us on Twitter at @Shield_GSM. And our popular Facebook group is at facebook.com/groups/AgentsOfShieldGSM.
And Mike and I will be back next week with our discussion of episode 6 of season 6 titled Inescapable. And remember, after the episode airs, you can head on over to goldenspiralmedia.com/feedback to share your thoughts. Write a message, record a comment using your computer's microphone, or you can call 304-837-2278.
And if you get a chance, please rate and review The Sandbox wherever you get your podcasts to let us know how you're enjoying our coverage of Marvel's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
And so remember, this isn't the end of the road, but we will continue to put you in danger.